and accused the Saudi led coalition of causing a humanitarian crisis for the whole nation.
The statements by the officials in the Hadi regime clearly show that the war is not the solution to the current problem in Yemen, and the country needs a political solution. The statements also reveal the constructive role of the Ansarullah group in the fight against the Saudi-led coalition. There is a growing public call for an end to the war in Yemen.
The Deputy Minister of Information in Sana'a, Nasruddin Amir, said these statements came in the right direction, and Sana'a encourages taking such stances against the Saudi-led coalition, even if they do not have a direct impact on the battle.
We welcome any protests within the Saudi-led coalition. These protests show the true nature of the coalition and come in the right direction. We know that this is the U.S. who is leading the war on Yemen.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen on March 2015 to return their protege, exiled former President Abdurrabbu Mansur Hadi, to power. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children, and pushed the country to the brink of famine.
For 7 years now, Saudi Arabia has failed to achieve any of its announced goals in the beginning of the war. Observers say Riyadh should start looking for other means, including a political solution, to get rid of the quagmire it's stuck with its war on Yemen, since the Yemeni army has proven that it is now a real threat to the kingdom more than ever. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As the winter draws near, relief material starts pouring in for destitute Rohingya refugees in India. But urge for schooling and educational material for their children is their biggest worry. Despite the UN conventions on the rights of child, irrespective of nationality, faith or ethnicity, the majority of Rohingya children continue to be deprived of any formal education, therefore threatening their future.
We have faced all the odds and miseries of this world, but we appeal to the world community not to ignore our generations and do everything possible to help us educate our children.
Several thousand Rohingya Muslims have been camping in parts of India for more than a decade, with nothing more to share rather than horrid tales of violent past. In almost all refugee camps, children would usually be seen spending time in dirt and filth, raising fears of disease and infections across the camps. Nevertheless, nobody cares, including them. This man says anxiously, "We will fight with life as long as we can, but the future worry of our children might kill us silently."
We have been living here in peace since the last 9 years, never faced any troubles. But now things look very challenging. India gave us hope of new life. We want to stay alive for our children, lest we have no hope left.
Regardless of refugee crisis the world has witnessed since last decade, this particular community continues to be unseen victims of violence, yet ignored or perhaps abandoned. Estimates suggest more than 40,000 Rohingya refugees live in India after fleeing a brutal crackdown in Myanmar. The UN refugee agency responsible to support them is of insignificant help, they say. Rights activists have time and again appealed to the Indian government to lend all possible support to the community, despite the fact they face threat to life back in Myanmar. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh, but it never endorsed any framework to safeguard the interests of these refugees. Now calls are growing for concrete refugee policy, irrespective of political agenda, faith or ethnicity.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin met with South Korean Minister of Defense Suk Thursday. The two counterparts agreed to develop new operational plans to deal with what Austin described as North Korea's destabilizing behavior.
The United States and the ROK remain committed to a diplomatic approach to the DPRK, and we continue to call upon the DPRK to engage in dialogue. But we also discuss measures to enhance our combined deterrence posture and to defend against the full range of threats.
Missile and nuclear programs. South Korea wants to see sanctions suspended and an official declaration to end the Korean War, two items apparently not near the top of the military chief's agenda. Meanwhile, outside South Korea's Ministry of National Defense, Activists called for Seoul to disentangle itself from an alliance with the U.S. and take control of its own national defense.
South Korean armed forces and military resources are likely to be dragged into U.S. Indo-Pacific strategies. We came here to denounce it and to deliver this message to the American authorities. The U.S. should return wartime operational control immediately.
Austin also called out China over its military buildup, as Washington now plans to move more forces, an attack helicopter squadron, and an artillery division headquarters to be stationed in South Korea. The meeting here between the leaders of the U.S. and the South Korean militaries comes following the release of the Pentagon's 2021 Global Posture Review. The U.S. will now place even more emphasis on deterring China and North Korea, with Washington calling for more help from its allies. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In draft documents presented to the signatories of the nuclear agreement, Iran is calling for the removal of all U.S. sanctions that violate the deal signed in 2015, known officially as the JCPOA. Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister and lead negotiator Ali Bagheri-Kani says the Iranian draft includes calls for the removal of all sanctions, especially those imposed under former President Donald Trump, as part of the U.S. maximum pressure campaign.
One of the fundamental issues is that no sanctions that violate the agreements, including those imposed under the Obama-Trump or Biden administrations, should stay. They're not acceptable. Some of this hadn't been considered in the previous draft. We've included our modifications.
Iran has called for the verifiable removal of sanctions and guarantees that the U.S. will not commit further violations. Tehran says the ball is now in the U.S. court.
I think this is beginning to sink in for the Europeans and the Americans, that this administration, the Iranian administration, will abide by the JCPOA, but it will not allow the Americans to get additional concessions. It will not allow the Europeans to get additional concessions. Iran did not appease Trump. It's not going to appease Biden.
Following talks with EU coordinator Enrique Mora on Thursday, Bagheri also met the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Mariano Grossi, expressing Iran's intention to continue its close cooperation with the agency and to remain actively engaged in the Vienna talks.
Iran's lead negotiator says he's warned other participants not to allow outside players to negatively influence or obstruct the process of talks, saying his team is serious about reaching an agreement and is ready to continue negotiations. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
As Yemenis celebrate Independence Day, the Aden Youth Movement called for an uprising against the presence of the Saudi-led coalition's forces and those affiliated with the Hadi regime in the occupied city in southern Yemen.
There is a growing public call for the withdrawal of the invaders from the southern governance, because their presence has deteriorated the ordinary people's living condition and the invaders are in full control of the country's oil and mineral wealth. Today, an awakening movement is coming into force, which is against the foreign presence. The movement reminds us of what our ancestors did when they expelled the British occupiers from southern Yemen in 1967.
The movement denounced the deteriorating living condition caused by the continued collapse of the local currency. The U.S. dollar's price has exceeded 1,600 riyals in the occupied areas, compared to 600 riyals in the liberated ones.
The public call for foreign forces withdrawal is completely legitimate because their presence has already led to the current deteriorating condition. It goes without saying that the U.S. and the Saudi-led coalition are the ones who bear the responsibility for these repercussions.
The devaluation of the local currency in the areas controlled by the Saudi-led coalition's forces has led to a surge in the prices of basic commodities such as food and medicine. This has hampered daily life for people who are suffering from long years of war. the depreciation of the local currency and the widespread poverty within the occupied southern areas has contributed to the growing public calls for the foreign forces withdrawal. People here in liberated areas believe that an armed struggle against the invaders is the only way out of the tragic situation in southern regions. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As more cases of the Omicron variant of COVID-19 are detected in Europe, questions mount over its true origin, how contagious it is, and of course the health threat. The matter was debated in the European Parliament on Tuesday.
The thing that's really on everybody's mind is the new variant.
The head of the European Medicines Agency, Eimear Cook, told lawmakers that greater efforts are needed to get more people vaccinated in the EU.
Especially in those member states where the rates are dangerously low. And this is particularly important as we learn more about Omicron.
Even though we know little about the new variant, EU countries are increasing restrictions. Most legislators agree that vaccination rollout remains key.
We were all a bit late in preparing the booster, and it is the biggest problem is, of course, that people don't get the first and second dose.
Citizens have been reacting to the latest developments.
With this new variant, well, I don't know. I mean, the economy is not actually quite strong, I would say, so where do we really balance, like, health, you know, and survival?
From the stock exchange's reaction, it may have a negative impact on our lives again in terms of economy.
One quarter of adults in the EU have still not been jabbed. A contributing factor to hesitancy, it has been suggested, is the refusal of pharmaceutical giants to release vaccine clinical trial data.
This is not just an issue of taxpayers' fund, but also an issue of trust. Trust in the European institution can be built by transparency.
Many EU legislators are saying it's imperative that Omicron serves as a warning. They are again repeating a message they've been trying to send to political leaders now for almost a year. The West must stop hoarding vaccines from poorer nations, otherwise more variants and perhaps more deadly variants will be coming. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of Halim, please.
Hi, Kitty, good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate.
praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when he created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when he authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing him. Terrents fall low in awe of him. Faces are humbled in fear of him. And everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, how long does it take for members of the so-called international community to forget about a ruler ordering the murder of a journalist, a crime which was so blatant that it took place in a consulate in a foreign country, and the murderers cut the journalist into pieces and discarded the remains. It appears 3 years is enough time for French President Emmanuel Macron to forget what happened to Saudi dissident and journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. And according to the CIA, he was killed by henchmen on the direct orders of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman MBS, the man Macron is in Saudi Arabia to see. What does it all mean? Stay with us as we take a look at this on the Spotlight.
French President Emmanuel Macron met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in the Saudi city of Jeddah and discussed a whole range of issues, including crisis in Lebanon, which has been suffering from economic hardships for the past several years. Macron's visit to Saudi Arabia is overshadowed by the 2018 assassination of Saudi critic and journalist Jamal Khashoggi. American intelligence agencies have concluded that the murder was directly ordered by Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS. The visit has drawn reactions from human rights groups. They accused the French president of trying to, quote, rehabilitate MBS. Critics argue that nothing can justify Macron's trip given Saudi Arabia's human rights violations.
Whatever strategic interest France has in Saudi Arabia, nothing can justify their legitimization of a ruler who kills journalists, threatens activists, imprisons women human rights defenders, slaughters Yemeni civilians, and deceives the international community. Macron diminishes himself and his country as he stoops to partnership with MBS.
Macron has rejected the accusations, claiming that the dialogue with Saudi Arabia was necessary to work for stability in the region. The visit is part of the two-day tour to the Persian Gulf that earlier took Macron to the UAE and Qatar. In the UAE, he signed a record $15.8 billion contract for selling 80 French Rafale warplanes. Rights bodies again came out vocal about the sale. They criticized the agreement, blaming the Emiratis for playing a prominent role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. Signing a major weapons deal with a country involved in the war on Yemen raises speculations as to what exactly Paris is looking for in such trips. Such a sale is especially under the spotlight at a time when France has been deprived of a share in a lucrative security pact among Australia, the UK, and the US. That, along with the fact that France is one of the largest weapons exported to Saudi Arabia, brings one to the conclusion that France is only after selling its military hardware, despite the war crimes Riyadh has committed and the irreparable loss of hundreds of thousands of civilian lives during the ongoing war on Yemen.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman out of Washington, D.C. And the director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto. Well, thank you both for being with me. I'm going to start this off in Washington. And Michael, what do you make of Macron's visit at this time?
Well, Macron, as one African journalist terms him, the cookie monster, given that his name is similar to the French cookie, Macaron, has delusions of grandeur. He wants to reestablish France as a world power, and he has pressured the Lebanese government to have their information minister resign after he had dared to criticize the Saudi war in Yemen. I think that Macron wants to sell more weapons, just like the British and the French do to the region. And there's certainly far too many weapons there now. And he wants to make up, as your commentator said earlier, for the loss of the submarine contract with Australia. I think that Macron is tied up with some rather unsavory characters like Mohammed bin Salman, who is, as your commentator said, is a essentially a repulsive and repressive despot. Who doesn't flinch at murder, at capturing people who are dissidents from other countries and jailing them. So I think that Macron should stay home and keep his mouth shut and help work to get the foreign soldiers out of the region like the Americans and other countries.
Well, Zafar, do you think that with his visit, Macron is basically giving a nod to his Western counterparts that the minor reprimand of not visiting Saudi Arabia via official delegations is now over?
Yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, most Western governments do not really care about human rights. Their overriding concern is to promote their economic interests, and in particular, weapons sales to a region that is already awash with billions of dollars worth of weapons that are being used against innocent people. We know both Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have been involved in this brutal war against Yemen since March of 2015, where, according to the United Nations' own estimates, several hundred thousand people have been killed. Also, Saudi Arabia is involved in destabilizing Lebanon. It has sent mercenaries into Syria and Iraq. And the UAE also, which is a partner in crime with the Saudis in Yemen, these new weapons that they have purchased, which obviously would be supplied by the year 2027. But it clearly indicates that as far as Macron is concerned and other Western rulers, they don't care about human rights. They basically only are interested in promoting their own interests. And if there is a government that stands up for its own rights, which is perceived as being contrary to the interests of these Western regimes, then of course these Western regimes trot out this argument of human rights. So I'm afraid this latest deal is going to further destabilize the region. It is not going to do anything for the people of the region.
Michael, how do you see it? I mean, is that the overall goal? You heard Zafar just now talk about that he's afraid that it's going to destabilize the region even more. Is that what it's all about? I mean, with these Western governments that claim that they believe in human rights and democracy and spreading it all over, but is it basically to keep these regions, specifically this region, destabilized? We see the unbelievable amount of weapons and military equipment sold in this region for them to basically get higher profit from the region, or your assessment of it all? What is it all about to you?
Well, my assessment is, just like the gentleman from Canada said, that the outside powers in the United States and in Europe like to keep the region stabilized so they can sell them weapons, so that they can ensure that Israel does not have any opposition of any meaningful strength and power, and that they can do as they will. They can offer deals to various government officials to do their bidding, money, visas, their students in Harvard University or someplace else in the United States or Canada or Europe. So the advantage is to keep the pot boiling, to have a reason for being in there, claiming that we need to help stabilize the region. That's why our soldiers, sailors, and Marines are there. And they don't look to the bigger picture of what is being done to Yemen, what is being done to Lebanon, what is being done to Iraq or Syria. They don't see the attacks on Iran. They whine and they complain that the Iranians are not negotiating in good faith in Vienna, even though the Americans...
Well, Michael, isn't that they don't see... Sorry to interrupt you. Is it that they don't see, or is it that they just basically don't care?
They see and they don't care. They see this as a means of emphasizing their ability to posture, to say that, yes, we are all for all this and that and the other thing, but we need to be in there and we need to have close contact with scumbags like Mohammed bin Salman or other creatures in the area. And that it's to their advantage. They look good. They sound good. And nobody questions what's really behind the rhetoric. and hot air.
Okay, with that fact, we look at, of course, Macron was, he not only went to Saudi Arabia, but also Qatar and the UAE. The UAE, he finalized a deal selling 80 fighter jets to this speck of a country, basically, if we want to say. What do you make of this? It's quite unbelievable. It's amazing that the world is not in outrage, like, why would this little country need 80 more fighter jets and not realizing the importance, the role of this place in destabilizing it even more. I'm saying, why isn't the rest of the world just not in outrage over this?
Well, essentially, much of the world, and when we talk about the world, we are talking essentially about Western powers. It is in their interest not to worry about the destabilizing effects of the policies of their allies. And what happens to the people of the region is something that they don't care about. We also need to keep in mind that the UAE is simply not capable. They do not have the wherewithal to be able to fly these planes. In fact, I can predict right from now that they will probably need to hire foreign pilots, most probably from Pakistan or Jordan or Egypt, to fly these planes for them. And of course, the French would make tons of money by sending their technicians that would supposedly maintain these this hardware that is going to be supplied to the United Arab Emirates. Unfortunately, the United Arab Emirates is punching way above its weight. It's a tiny country, it has a tiny population, and the majority of the population in the UAE is in fact foreigners. They can't even do much of the work themselves. So what we are witnessing is a situation whereby the UAE is being encouraged by these massive weapons purchases to become even more unruly. We know that the UAE has been involved in Libya, it was involved in Syria. It was even accused by Turkey of having its hand in the July 2016 coup. So we see that this tiny country, this speck of a country, is actually punching way above its weight, and it is likely to find some times ahead if it tries to grapple and chew too much, because it won't be able to swallow it. Of course, we also see that the UAE is going headlong with its so-called normalization with the Zionist regime in occupied Palestine. And again, I can foresee that the UAE is going to lose because they're not going to be able to hoodwink the Zionists to benefit the people or the government of the United Arab Emirates.
Michael, your perspective, how much does Zafar said, the Zionist regime play in all of this? On the one hand, we have these Western countries and wanting to make their own profits and keeping it destabilized. But how much is it also trying to keep the area destabilized? One, because it benefits Israel, and two, also, how much does it play into trying to control and pressure the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Well, I think that's entirely correct. The Israelis, the apartheid entity, are deeply involved in trying to split the Arab world, buddying up to the Gulf states, essentially lines on a map, and improving relations with the Saudis, of course, is in keeping with the repressive nature of Israel and its efforts to destroy its neighbors repeatedly since its illegitimate creation. The Israelis have been having a fine time selling their spyware around the world, and they've even managed to sell it, I guess, to the Ugandans so they could spy on the American embassy there. That's just been a major issue. The Israelis work and dangle carrots of money and investment and travel and trade and things like this to the Arab world to make them forget all about the Palestinians and what's been done to them, and to gain allies and to ensure a monolith opposed to Iran, which is Israel's real enemy besides the United States. As long as they can do this, they're happy, they're making money, they're acquiring information, they are gaining a hand in the operation of the governments of these various countries in the region. So it's all to their benefit that they destabilize the area and make a profit out of it.
Zafar, how complicit do you see these Western governments in Saudi and UAE crimes that have taken place? I mean, you talked about a couple of them before, whether we're talking about Syria or we're talking about Libya or we're talking about Yemen. I mean, how complicit are these entities themselves for selling these type of weapons, for supporting, even giving air support sometimes to these regimes in these different countries?
I think the Western complicity is absolutely obvious. Let us begin with reviewing the Saudi-led war on Yemen, which was announced in the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C. on March 26, 2015. Now, you would think that a country that is going to wage war on another country, they would make that announcement in their own capital city, their own government would be making those decisions, and yet that decision was made from the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C. So that's a clear indication that the Americans had given the green light to the Saudis and their so-called allies to proceed with that war crime to attack the people of Yemen. And, of course, we know that the Americans provide logistical support to the Saudis. The British are involved. The French are involved. They are basically even selecting targets for the Saudis to bomb. But, of course, the Saudis are so incompetent that they often miss those targets, and instead they have been killing civilians. They have destroyed civilian infrastructure, whether it is hospitals, schools, warehouses where grain is kept, and other facilities. So when we look at the Saudi-led war in Yemen, obviously the Western governments are fully involved and fully complicit. And this extends, of course, all across the region. When we look at Syria, the United States still has its forces in Syria illegally occupying a part of Syria when the Syrian government has not given it permission to station its forces over there. The Americans have been basically supporting Daesh terrorists, and there is ample proof of that, that it was the Americans that created this monstrous group so that it would destabilize these governments, whether it is in Syria or in Iraq. Of course, in Iraq, Daesh has been defeated thanks to the efforts of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and in particular, General Qasem Soleimani, the martyr, who was martyred because he was so successful against these terrorist groups. And even now, the Americans have their forces in Iraq, and although an agreement was signed that these forces would be pulled out by the end of 2021, and yet the Americans are simply going to change their designation and say that, well, now they're not going to be involved in a combat mission. They're only going to be involved in training the Iraqi army. And so they will still continue to stay over there. So in terms of Western complicity, I don't think that there is any doubt. The Western governments are completely complicit in the crimes that are being committed in that region against innocent people. Regrettably, we don't have an international order in which these real war criminals can be brought to justice. And that is why the people are then left with no choice but to rise up and resist these criminal forces, just as it's happening in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq, etc.
So, Michael, on the one hand, we have the what Zafar talks about is the Western complicity. On the other hand, there seems to be this strange competition between these Western countries. It's as if they are so desperate financially, economically, to see who can sell the most at any cost. I mean, the combination just creates total chaos in the region. Your take on this, what can be done?
Well, unfortunately, nothing much can be done because, for example, in the United States, the sales to these countries of various sorts of weapons is really big business. Joe Biden, who campaigned on the basis of, oh, we're opposed to the war in Yemen, is selling $650 million worth of missiles to the Saudi Air Force. So it's say one thing and do another. And unfortunately, the people themselves in the United States and in Europe simply go along with this. They're more concerned with the virus and who's got which variant of the virus. They are concerned with keeping their jobs or getting a better job. They're people that don't associate with others because they might get the virus and therefore don't have time to read the newspaper if there is, in fact, any news in it. I was in Missoula, Montana for a week, and the local paper, the Missoulian, is basically half sports and half local news on the front page. So there's no real interest, there's no real information coming to anyone outside of what comes from the main news media, which simply parrots the government line. Basically, it comes down to nobody knows anything, nobody wants to do anything, and nobody cares.
And Zafar, Michael talked about the American people. What about the people of the region? Do you see them more and more as separating from their dictatorial rulers, becoming more and more aware of how basically they've been used and played by their regime leaders and sold out to create basically this instability and to steal their natural resources?
Well, there are different categories. For instance, when we look at Yemen, the people of Yemen, of course, have risen up. Similarly, the people of Syria against these foreign aggressors, and to some extent in Iraq. Unfortunately, in regimes like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, people have been led on this hedonistic path. While we speak, for instance, there in Saudi Arabia, there are massive concerts going on in which the people are being moved into this culture of pop music and dance and etc. And in other words, people are being entangled in vulgarity so that the people's attention would be moved away from what the regime is doing. But I'm afraid they will not last too long. I think there are rumblings of revolt, and ultimately these regimes would be consigned to the dustbin of history, as a number of other regimes were 10 years ago. So I think it's just a matter of time before the reality catches up with these regimes and people rise up in a proper way and get rid of these corruptors that are oppressing their own people.
And the reality of time has caught up with us, too, and that brings us to the end of this program. I appreciate both of you being with me, author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman, out of Washington, D.C., director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Banga, out of Toronto. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Oil and gas exports from the U.S. Gulf Coast have surged by nearly 600%, and fossil fuel production in the Permian Basin has grown by 135%, says Kenny Stencil, journalist, in an article titled, "Since Congress Lifted Crude Export Ban in 2015, U.S. has dropped climate bomb on world." Stay tuned for more. After Congress lifted a ban on crude exports in late 2015, oil and gas production in Permian Basin soared, while domestic consumption remained flat, leading to a massive build-out of pipelines and other infrastructure that culminated in the U.S., flooding global markets with fossil fuels at the expense of humanity in general and vulnerable U.S. Gulf Coast communities already overburdened by pollution in particular. That's the focus of the third chapter of the Permian Basin Climate Bomb, a six-part multimedia report by Oil Change International, Earthworks, and the Center for International Environmental Law. The latest installment released recently shows that the drilling and fracking boom that turned this area in the U.S. southwest to the world's single most prolific oil and gas field over the past decade was not driven by rising domestic demand, but by a surge in exports after 2015. Between 2015 and 2020, U.S. oil consumption actually declined by 7%. There was no corresponding decrease in extraction in New Mexico and Texas, however. Instead, fossil fuel production in Permian Basin increased by 135% during the same time period. That growth in output coincided with a simultaneous increase in oil and gas exports from the U.S. Gulf Coast, which skyrocketed by 589% from 2015 to 2020. Before December 2015, when sales were restricted to Canada, crude exports made up 5% of oil and gas production. By 2020, they reached 30%. According to the report, the export boom is not confined to crude. The author cites Matt Schatzman, a CEO of a liquefied natural gas LNG company, who said in 2019 that every incremental hydrocarbon produced in Permian Basin from this day forward, whether it is oil, liquids, or gas, needs to be exported. Uh,
as the report notes, it is no coincidence that production growth in Permian Basin accelerated after crude oil export restrictions were lifted by Congress in late 2015. But repealing the ban was not enough on its own to trigger the twin booms of both production and exports in Permian and U.S. Gulf Coast. For the surge in exports and production to materialize, a vast network of pipelines, processing plants, storage tank farms, and export terminals had to be built, states the report, adding, "The build-out of pipelines in the last 5 years has been particularly intense." This infrastructure, the report points out, burdens communities with pollution and safety risks, and locks in a system of energy and chemical supply that the world can no longer sustain. In addition to the construction of over 12,000 miles of pipelines since the end of 2015, U.S. Gulf Coast export terminal capacity has increased more than threefold since the ban was lifted, the report says. Additional export capacity could lower the cost of and accelerate crude exports, which could lock in gas supply to countries that could be moving more quickly to renewable energy. In response to Permian oil and gas producers' plan to increase production by more than 50% from 2021 to 2030, the focus of second chapter of the report, Lauren Stockman, research co-director at Oil Change International, said that this must not happen. The third chapter of the report highlights several proposed export terminals facing community opposition, including the Seaport Oil Terminal, or SPOT, located near Surfside Beach, Texas, the Texas Gulf Link Terminal near Jones Creek, Texas, the Rio Grande LNG Terminal near Brownsville, Texas, and the Plaquemines LNG Terminal near Ironton, Louisiana. John Beard, a member of the Port Arthur Community Action Network, said in a statement that gas from Permian fuels, the industrial beast of pollution in the Gulf Coast, especially in Port Arthur, Texas, my home. This boom has contributed to environmental degradation, significant loss of quality of life, non-attainment air quality, waterborne pollution, and diminished health for fence line community, Beard continued. Fracked Permian gas contributes to our significantly higher risk of cancer, heart, lung, and kidney disease, he added, noting that unmitigated greenhouse gas pollution will increase the frequency and intensity of hurricanes and catastrophic flooding. Beard said that Port Arthur and the entire U.S. Gulf Coast has become a sacrifice zone so America can feed its thirst for toxic fossil fuels. We can no longer afford to be the unwitting victim of this exploitation from the use of fracked Permian gas, he added. It needs to end now and utilize clean, green, renewable sources of energy in its instead. We say keep in the ground. The International Energy Agency recently reiterated its message that there is no need for investment in new fossil fuel production, adding that the extraction and burning of dirty energy must decline this decade while the worldwide generation of clean energy must accelerate immediately. Just before the start of COP26, meanwhile, the United Nations Environment Program lamented the fact that global fossil fuel use is projected to increase this decade, even as annual reductions in coal, oil, and gas production are necessary to avert the worst consequences of the climate crisis. According to an analysis released during the summit by Climate Action Tracker, the planet is currently on pace for 2.4 degrees Celsius of heating this century, unless countries, starting with the rich polluters most responsible for exacerbating extreme weather, rapidly and drastically slash greenhouse gas emissions, ramp up the transition to renewable energy
and enact transformative political economic changes.
From the heart of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio.